Welcome to the latest episode of the Pandemic Podcast with myself, Dan Aston Gregory, today joined by our special guest, Dr. Wolfgang Vodag. The big question we're asking today, is this a pandemic deja vu? Is this all about a virus? We're going to look back over the history of other pandemics to examine some of the similarities with what we've seen. Digging a little deeper, you'll quickly find that the COVID-19 global response bears more than a few similarities to what happened after the World Health Organization declared H1N1 swine flu a pandemic back in 2009. The World Health Organization definition of pandemic has changed just a month prior to that pandemic, focusing on infections rather than severity of disease through measures like mortality. And much of the wildly inaccurate modelling was also provided by our very own Professor Neil Ferguson and his Imperial College colleagues. And at the centre of the H1N1 storm was today's guest, Dr. Wolfgang Vodag, a physician, pulmonary specialist, epidemiologist and former German MP. As then chair of the Health Committee of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe, he forced a debate early in 2010 on Big Pharma's influence on the global swine flu campaign and the accompanying rush to develop vaccines. One of those vaccines was GSK's Pandemrix, which caused the deaths of at least 1,300 children across Europe and left many thousands with more lifelong neurological injuries, including narcolepsy. It had not been tested upon children. Fast forward to 2020, and in spring last year, the world was plunged into lockdowns, again, in significant measure on the back of Professor Ferguson's modelling, with, again, the accompanying race to find vaccines for COVID-19 rapidly underway. In tonight's episode, I'll be exploring with Dr. Vodag the parallels between these two pandemics and many of the other pandemics that have gone before us to explore many of the issues which seemingly have very little to do with managing the virus at all. So a huge welcome to you. Great to have you here tonight on this special podcast episode.
Hi, everyone. Yes.
So firstly, it must feel somewhat like deja vu to you at this minute in time.
Yes, it is a little bit deja vu, but it was not so severe. It was not such a big thing the last time in 10 years ago in 2009. It started differently, and it seemed to me only a thing of the pharmaceutical industry, of the vaccination industry. Now it seems something much bigger. It seems something politically important, and we know now in the meantime who prepared all this stuff and who was cooperating. So we know the background, the political background of and the economic background of all what is happening now. We have much more information now. And it was not that big in those times, 2009. And I think there is a big difference. It seems to me it was an exercise in 2009, and they waited some years to make us forget, and now they did the big thing.
Okay, so by way of background then, firstly, could you tell us a little bit about your involvement in the swine flu pandemic? Obviously, one of the first things that I learned about you is your work with the European Council. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened in 2009?
You know, it started in 2005 with the bird flu. It was the first time I was in Parliament, and I heard that our government wanted to buy the Tamiflu tablets against the flu. It was the bird's flu which was announced then to come all over the world, and with the birds, with the flying birds, and they put nets over the meadows where the goose were running. So they made really fear that we could be infected by some virus coming from birds. And I could not imagine how this could happen, because the viruses are specialized, and how do they know that the virus was just jumping in time to human beings? So I traveled to the WHO and to meet Mr. Stöhr. He was the head of this department there in WHO for pandemics, and I interviewed him. I asked him, Mr. Stöhr, please tell me the evidence. Why do you make such a fear to people? He spoke about some million deaths that could happen. And he just gave me a CD, and I took it home, and it was a CD which was advertising Tamiflu. And he could not give me any evidence how this virus could jump from birds to human beings. There was no parallel. It was just some virological theory, and it was very poor what he could offer. So I was warning at home. I went home, so don't buy this stuff. And it's a tablet which has side effects too. There were side effects reported from Japan, from children psychologically disturbed by this drug. And so I said, no, we don't need it. It doesn't help. And afterwards we found out with other scientists, Tom Jefferson and Peter Doshi from British Medical Journal, we found out that Roche didn't publish all the results they had about Tamiflu, but they kept it as a secret for many years, and they had to go to court to get it, and they had to make pressure to get all the information. And in the end, they found out Tamiflu had more negative than positive effects. So this was the first experience. And knowing this, I heard about Mexico in 2009. I heard about Mexico, and I heard about some 600 and so cases. And Neil Ferguson was the one who presented this with his big graphics and with big PowerPoint pictures. He presented it to the WHO, to the experts there. And I got his publication then, and I was very astonished because I saw there were only some less than 1,000 cases, 600 and something, I think in April it was, 2009. And I was thinking of my own experience in the region where I was a director of a public health institution. I was in charge of watching the flu seasons, so I knew when there is a flu season, there are about 3% of the population, if it's a heavy flu season, is ill. Each week, 3% is touched by this flu and gets some with fever, without fever, more severe, less severe, and that doesn't go to work. So I made a sentinel myself. And in my region, it was Mrs. Thompson. She was working in my office. And I asked each Monday to take a phone and to make a phone call to always the same doctors, the same to the clinics, to the employers, to the military sanitary service, and to some big offices, and always asking the same questions: what about flu cases? What about the typical symptoms of flu? Has it become this week less or more, or what do you think? And so she gave me, within 3 or 4 hours, she gave me the results of her questioning those institutions. And I always knew there is something coming, or no, there's nothing coming. I had a very good, and this was a region of 150,000 inhabitants. And when the flu season came, there were 10,000 people ill. So right. When I heard about 600 cases in Mexico, and seeing all those funny pictures, I looked had a closer look, and I saw that they just multiplicated those 600 cases with all those aeroplanes going all over the world, and with the possibilities, the passenger of those airplanes could spread the disease from Mexico. It was a calculation game, what they did. It had nothing to do with reality, nothing to do with illness, nothing to do with viruses. So this, I observed this and said, this is a nonsense. And I started speaking about it and publishing about it and said, it's a false alarm. Mm. Be careful. And when I heard then that they were preparing vaccines against it, I found out that since 2005 or even before, they had this plan. And there was this pandemic preparedness. It was running already for several years. This pandemic preparedness was always involving some vaccination schemes. And the governments all over the world, it were more than 100 governments that made contracts with firms producing this vaccines. And those about 100 countries, the contracts were secret. They were not published. And I got two contracts of it. I got from whistleblowers, one from France and one from Germany. And they were similar. And both contracts said that those contracts, that they were in power, that they were valid in case WHO would say it's level number 6 of the pandemic. And this was a plan, a pandemic alertness plan. And so I observed this, and I saw there were some mock-up vaccines already prepared. this was Glaxo and this was Novartis, and I think there was some other firms who did it too, but those two I observed very closely because they had contracts in Germany, each of them 25 million doses of vaccines. And when I saw this, I was very cautious because I found out that in those vaccines they had some boosters. They had booster of the they tried to booster the immune system, that they need a lower dose of antigen, but making a stronger reaction. So they boosted the immune system. And this is a very dangerous thing because then this may lead to immune, autoimmune diseases and misreactions of the immune system, as we experienced afterwards with the narcolepsy and all those cases. And the other from Novartis, this was a new production. They were not breeding the virus on eggs, but they were breeding it in bioreactors. In those bioreactors, there were cells growing very fast as tumor cells. Very fast. And if you always, when you produce vaccines, you always have some, they're not 100% clean. There are always some rests of the stuff which they are extracted from. And then, so I thought when there is proteins of those tumor-like cells in the vaccines, they could induce tumor. And to find out whether they do or whether they don't, you need at least five to six years of testing them. And this was not. And so I said, keep away from those vaccines. And I was successful that time. My alarm led to cancel the Novartis contract. And but Glaxo was happy because they were the only ones who sold then. This was not canceled. But the German doctors were alerted. And because, as an example, in Sweden, Sweden has much less inhabitants than Germany. So they had about 4 million vaccinations, and Germany too, only 4 million vaccinations. And although we are 8 times more or 9 times more people in Germany. And the doctors were cautious, and the doctors didn't give those vaccines. Now it is different. They have learned from this period, from the swine flu, and they tried to bypass the doctors. They make big stations for vaccines. They employ doctors who don't have their own patients, who just have free time. They just employ some doctors, and they pay them very well. In Germany, they get 170 euros an hour in those vaccine centers. So it's almost like bribing a doctor to help them with this evil method to spread their vaccines. And they had enough doctors to do it, and like this, they bypassed the whole thing, and they could do it in a way. We see it now.
Mm. So you mentioned there for the swine flu, there was contracts in place already. Now, just playing devil's advocate a little bit in terms of preparedness for a future pandemic or epidemic, does it make sense to have some plans in place for medical intervention, or is that? What are your views on?
Yes, I think it's useful to have. But I have to speak about vaccination against the respiratory viruses. You know, respiratory viruses change each year. Hmm. They mutate. We know it. We hear about mutations all the time. And this is normal. This is what always happens. This happened long before, many, many hundred years. It happens already. And the human immune system is very much used to this. Hmm. It is used to all those more than 100 viruses coming as respiratory viruses each year, and they all they have some competition sometimes. Sometimes they have some synergisms in our mucosa where they try to grow, and we have the immune system which is very much alerted then, and which knows all of them. When you're in kindergarten or when you're in school as a young child, you learn them all. They come each year, and you had a snotty nose then. And this is a sign that your immune system is heavily on training. It's really good training. And the children don't get ill. This is normal. This is a very big capacity of the cellular immunity we have with the beginning of our breathing of the airways. And so we only speak about immunity. Many doctors don't speak about immunity when they measure something in the blood, when they have antibodies in the blood. But it's not the antibodies in the blood normally. It's just the cellular immunity, the local cellular immunity, which is already sufficient to help us not to get ill from all those viruses. We are in touch each year. And we also know when you give a vaccine against one of them, this was tested intensively with influenza. When you, for instance, vaccine against influenza, you may have in one jab, you may have antigens against three different kinds of influenza, or four even. This doesn't help you. You will get ill nevertheless, because taking away the chance for influenza helps the other viruses to have more space, and they will be lucky to spread better without those competitors from influenza. So there were studies with old people, with children, and there was in the Pentagon study very thousands of people who were a control group without vaccination against influenza and with influenza, with vaccination, and they found out the frequency of getting ill with flu didn't change so much, but the spectrum of viruses changed a lot, and so like it will stay like this, whatever against corona or against influenza, it's the same. You will just have bigger chance for other viruses. And even for other influenza viruses or other coronaviruses subtypes. So I think the vaccination is just is a stress for human beings, is a stress for the viruses. But the viruses are used to such stress, and they are very flexible, and they are very rapidly adopting the situation, and it's the evolution of viruses is rapidly. You have to know from the beginning of last year to now, there have been around 4,000 mutations of the coronavirus that was observed as a SARS virus in Wuhan. And they make a connection, those taxonomic people, the taxonomic trees, they make the ancestry of viruses. And they say, oh, this is Wuhan virus, and they make a tree and all the different viruses then spreading from all the branches of this ancestry. And they have 4,000 such branches. They were found all over the world, and they found different clades, so they have a similarity them. And now they give us the impression that this is a singular event, that this only happened, but no. If you had started in Birmingham in 2019, you had a Birmingham virus, and from Birmingham it would spread all over the world. You would have the same kind of tree, because all viruses just try to extract genes and try to adapt to new hosts. This is what happens all the time, all over the world, each year. And the narrative we now get presented is that there's something happened in Wuhan, which was very dangerous. They even tell us that those gain-of-function viruses, which were experimented in Wuhan, they escaped and they killed some people. Maybe. I don't say it's not true. It may be because those gain-of-function viruses are very dangerous, perhaps. And those people who have close contact in laboratories or their families or in a hospital, they are endangered. And they may die. And they may get seriously ill. But you know, the more dangerous a virus is, the less it is dangerous for epidemic risks, because a virus that kills its host cannot spread.
Hmm.
If people stay at home, they are ill. They don't go out. They don't drive with a car. They don't go to work. They don't go to school. So really dangerous viruses kill the hosts, and they cannot spread. Those viruses who don't kill us, those viruses that we don't even recognize, they are the most successful viruses in spreading. And so there are two things. In Wuhan, there was some story with dangerous viruses. Okay. In the same time, there was Mr. Drosten from Charité in Germany who said, I have a test where you can find this virus. It's the PCR test. And when you take my test, you will find the virus. When he published his his work there, where he presented it to the WHO, he already said that this test also is positive with other SARS viruses already being in Europe with bats. But there is no virus for 20 years. You know, SARS virus, we know it for more than 20 years. So the similar viruses, we know them, and they have spread all over the world. They are not only in bats. They are in many. They were found in tigers. They were found in cats. They were found in, I don't know what, many, many species. But we've never looked for them. And when I was observing the sentinels from Robert Koch Institute in Berlin, where they have regular sentinels, where they always observe how many people are ill, like I did in my constituency there. They do it for Germany, and they have about, I think it's 700 doctors in Germany. They sent some tests they sent to the laboratory, and they try to find out which viruses are on the way this season. And they never looked for coronaviruses because they thought coronavirus, no, not interesting, it's not dangerous. Although they knew that SARS viruses exist. They just were not caring for coronavirus because they knew coronavirus is one of the less harmful viruses, because it mostly is in the upper airways and it's not as dangerous as influenza, for instance. And this is suddenly in March last year they started observing coronaviruses, and they found them. But the PCR is something extra. It was. Beside all those normal observations of flu and of the virus, of the variety of viruses, it was just an extra thing out of it. They started making PCRs. And they only looked for coronaviruses, although they knew all the other viruses are still there. And they were examining all thousands of people, millions of people in Germany. In 1 week, 1.5 million people were tested. And we know that the test is not very specific on one virus. This virus they were looking for didn't even exist anymore. There were the varieties already. But this test said always positive, positive, positive. And even in summer, when there is no coronavirus, because we don't find it normally. And they found something with PCR, but which is just the false positive rate, what they measured. And the false positive rate is about 2%, 1.5. And if you do 1 million tests, you have enough to tell the people, oh, there is still coronavirus. And this is how they kept us in fear. This is how they kept up this being afraid of being, infected. And this is the PCR is something different, has nothing to do with what happened in Wuhan. The PCR is a special invention. And what we measure with the PCR is the activities of those who use it, nothing else.
I mean, in the UK, you know, we've done freedom of information requests, and we've seen hospital labs using cycle thresholds in excess of 45, which, you know, we've come to learn is very highly likely to produce false positive results. But the challenge is these case numbers are being used in the papers like a daily stock tick to inflate the fear around the virus. And again, it doesn't mean there hasn't been a viral outbreak, but it's how it's detected and measured and presented that I think is a real issue. Now, what's your take on what's happened in the last 12 months? You know, we have seen excess mortality. Do you think this is what factors do you think have led to that excess mortality in particular?
Yes, you know, there is not only the virus that we were looking for in the PCR test. There were lockdowns, and there were many measures taken to protect us. And what happened there? All those effects, those side effects. It has never been proven with evidence that something like that helps. You know, I was looking for masks, the effect of masks. I was looking for distance, keeping distant. I was looking for all those measures of keeping people apart and leaving them at home and so on. And I'm a specialist not only for lung diseases. I also have a specialization on hygiene, and I was working in hospitals as a specialist for hygiene. So I know something about what is protecting people and what is protecting, not protecting. I myself worked in a special hospital for 2 years for tuberculosis. So I examined many people who were very infectious and with a dangerous bacteria. And so, you know, I know about masks and about the use of masks. There's lots of literature before 2020. And all the, if you have a look on the literature on the effectivity, on the effectiveness of masks, you see that the masks don't bring don't have any use when it's about such respiratory viruses. It was always, they try to find out with influenza, which has a similar size and a similar way to spread as coronaviruses have. And they didn't find that, they didn't find any use for those masks. There was some theory that if you have a very humid speech, that you may protect some people, but it's not even clear whether those viruses come with the big drops or with a small fog you breathe on. So, it is the best thing you can do is you have one population with 100,000 people. They try to protect themselves with masks, and you have in the same season, and you have the neighboring town, and they don't. So, yeah. And the only exercise I saw was in Denmark. They tried something like that in the beginning of 2020, and they didn't find any significant difference between those who wore a mask and those who did not. And all the other science results, scientific results on the effective, on the effect of masks, they were negative. Masks don't protect, but they are dangerous because you have a higher carbon dioxide concentration when you breathe. So for children, they are really damaging children then, and old people with COPD and all asthma and all those people having difficulties to breathe. So there is no indication for masks. But in the beginning of 2020, so from February, suddenly there were lots of studies on the effect of masks. And suddenly, starting from that time, they have positive results. They said, yes, maybe they have some effect. Yes, maybe they take away the droplets, and this is a good thing. And so, they made some experimental studies. They didn't make so many epidemiological studies because this needs time. The only really good one I saw is this Danish study there, but the others, they were bad studies, and many of them had positive results in favor for to wear masks. You know how this comes, because who pays the study, he can decide what is published and what is not, and it's just we have a corrupt science. This is very clear. We have an institutional corruption in science, and this is long lasting already. And we have all those scientific approaches where we try to find out how corrupt is science and medicine. I was in the last 10 years, I was leader of the working group in Transparency International, working group on health, trying to find out corruption in the health system, and I was intensively working there. And I had many struggles with the British chapter, who is paid by Glaxo and others, you know, who are corrupt themselves, to my mind. And so I said goodbye to Transparency some month ago, last year. But there, when I was still working there, I was always. I had contacts with international people who are doing the same work, and it was clear that there were very good results, where thousands of publications were watched and were reviewed. And they found out whether if you have a sponsor that is a private sponsor who gives money for a certain question to be answered by scientists, there are as double the positive results as if it would be paid by official, by public money. So when the sponsor first can say what to research, which research should be done and which not, he can put the questions. And on the other hand, he can say, no, don't publish this. I don't want this. because when they give money, they mostly have such a gagging clause in their contracts that they can say, we have to see it first before you publish, and we have a veto right. So there were very, very bad situation in medical science, and I think there are lots of drugs that are prescribed now by doctors where we could know better, where we should know better.
Well, it's felt like medical mafia, if I'm quite honest about the situation. You know, it's a really mafia. It just feels mafioso. I would like to take a moment to kind of take a step back in history. You mentioned your work with transparency, but the situation is more extreme now. I think I'd be interested to learn the investigation that took place with the Council of Europe into H1N1. Based upon some of the similar principles, and the fact that, you know, projections and modeling was overinflating the extent of the epidemic and a whole culture of fear surrounding it, and then utilizing that to propagate the need for these vaccinations. And so what actually happened at the Council of Europe, and what was the outcome of that investigation?
Yes, as the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe is a parliamentary assembly of parliamentarians who come from the national parliaments. They are delegations from all national parliaments. The bigger countries have more. And so Britain and in UK and in Germany, they have, I think, 18 parliamentarians and 18 who could replace them. So the delegation is the biggest one, France also, and I think Russia has a big one. And this is 47 states. It's not the EU. It's the big Europe. Mm-hmm. Only Belarus is not member. But all the other European countries, also the Caucasus countries, so Georgia and Armenia, Azerbaijan, they are all in. And then when we meet 4 weeks a year, the sessions of the parliamentary assembly is in 4 weeks, in the December session, in the last session of the year, or it was before. No, it was not in the session, big session. It was only the committee meeting in Paris. Mm-hmm. Where I was the president of this subcommittee, there I used my chance, and I tabled a motion which was called "Fake Pandemic," which was very provocative, and they were all looking at it. And so, I did it because before, as a German parliamentarian, I started at home, trying to catch attention of my comrades and of my fellow politicians, and I didn't succeed. There were some articles in some newspapers, yes, okay, but they all wanted to avoid this discussion. They didn't have anything to do with medical theories and with immune system and with viruses. So the politicians were not very keen to have a thorough look on the problems. So I was very frustrated. I remember the last session of my group, political group, the Social Democrat in Germany, when my minister, Ulla Schmidt, she was talking to the 200 people there, saying, "Oh, comrades, we have enough vaccination stuff. You can go to your constituencies and you can tell the people they needn't be afraid. We have enough vaccination for all of them." And I showed up and I said, "This is a big fake. First, we don't need the vaccinations. Secondly, it's very dangerous. And the third thing, there are all those secret contracts. They are horrible. And what's going on with the WHO is a big scandal, because they're all the experts there who decide whether there's a pandemic or not. They are, most of them are dependent on pharmaceutical industry." So I told them all this. And I spoke about, I don't know, something between 5 or 10 minutes. I really explained it. And it was all quiet, very quiet in the whole hall with all the, I think there were 250 parliamentarians in it. And the minister. And the boss of the group, all of them, they are not normally, they are not people who stop speaking, they're all quiet. And when I finished my speech, they kept quiet. And the president of our group said, Anyone else to say something against it or something? No one showed up. So he said, I wish you a good election campaign. Goodbye, comrades. And so, and that was it. And I was terribly frustrated about that reaction. And this is why I went to Paris, and this is why I went to the Council of Europe. I said, okay, if you in Germany, you don't want it, I will try my best to transport it to the European level and make a motion there. And there I succeeded immediately. The bad thing was that I was not elected because my party was so bad that it lost so many votes and I had no chance to re-enter because I always had a bad place on the list in my party because I always was a little bit uncomfortable. It was always very often I was opposition in my own party. I have to give in, but yes. So we had this topic in the Council of Europe, and it was immediately tabled, and it was immediately decided on that we have an enquête commission, that we have a research commission on it. And the topic was, they changed it a little bit, this fake pandemic. They spoke about more transparency and such things. They made it a little bit more diplomatic. Yes. But it was Paul Flynn from the Labour Party from UK that I prepared him. I knew that I was not elected, and I asked him whether he could take it over, because when you are not elected in October or September or so, you keep being member until the new delegation is voted by Parliament. So I kept until January. I was member of the Parliamentary Assembly. I'm still member now, as an honourable member now, but not so no politician anymore. But so I asked Paul to take over, and he was very experienced in dealing with the pharmaceutical industry, so he was a good one to follow this. And he promised me that he would invite me as expert to help him and to accompany this action. So I was in the audition, and I was in all this, and I could work as if I would be parliamentarian. I could, as an expert, I could put all the questions I wanted to put them. And there were the WHO only came once. They came, Mr. Fukuda came, and the press, the media boss came, the speaker, but they only came once. They didn't come again. They didn't like the question so much. And we found out then in all those auditions we had with very good scientists that they changed the definition of a pandemic, that they just took away the many severe cases, and they took away the death cases, and so they made a definition that they from 2009 on, from May 2009 on, each flu you could define as a pandemic. Because it's always new viruses, they are spreading to many countries. This were the only indicators for a pandemic from then on, and this has become still worse. Now we don't have pandemic, but we have a continuous pandemic. We only have a pre-pandemic situation. We have a post-pandemic situation, the pre-pandemic situation, the post. So they make us acquaintance, or they make us used to that a pandemic is a perpetual thing. And the flu waves are perpetual, but that we call it pandemic is just a trick for fear mongering
Oh, absolutely. And now here we are in 2021, over 12 months since the outbreak of SARS-CoV-2. And we're all experiencing how our everyday life and freedoms are being controlled, and how our health is suddenly now being tracked and tested and traced and quantified, registered and made the criteria for our own freedoms. Yet prior to this, health was our own business, but now everything is different because of this single pathogen. So what's happened within this pandemic, and why do you think this one is different?
You know, you have very good people in Glasgow, in Scotland. They know better than me. And because they monitor the viruses coming each year. And they don't monitor only one virus, but they monitor as much as we have tests for. So they take 20 or so, they take more. And they do this already since more than 10 years. And they have very good very good research on how the viruses come together and how they there are synergisms and how they have their competitions and what happens when a certain couple of viruses come together and when another and other ones come together. So they have an ecological approach to the situation, to the virome. This is in our body. And I think this is very clever. This is very good. This is much more sustainable in science than what we do now, running after one virus, which is not even really defined. And so what happens now is just that they make us afraid of this result of PCR tests. And this is something which has nothing to do with virology. This has nothing to do with immunology. This is just to do with, it's politics, and it's people try to reach something, making us afraid. And you have to read Naomi Klein when you want to understand it.
Yes.
About the strategy. how is it called? The fear strategy or shock strategy, she called it.
The shock doctrine. Yes. Yeah. Yes. The fear of contagion.
Very often used strategy to deregulate a population. If you have fear, if you succeed to spread fear among people, the democratic, you always have reasons to bypass democratic ways of decision. And you can say, it's an urgent case. We have just to do it. And those people who are at the steering wheel, they misuse this. And there are secondary interests that interfere. And the worst thing is the media. When Glaxo did it with the swine flu, I observed that the son of Mr. Murdoch, he was becoming director for 2 years, just in that time, in the Glaxo board of directors. The son of Mr. Murdoch of the media guy there, and this is how they really prepare this such things, and without the media, we would not experience all this. And we, as a society, we are dependent on the media. We are dependent on the media because what we can experience ourselves without media is just in our constituencies, just in our neighborhood, is just in a small region. We can travel a little bit and make ourselves a picture, but this is not sufficient. So we are always dependent on what the media tells us. And the media has to be independent. There is no economic force and no politic force who should interfere, and they do, both.
Yes.
Do.
Yep.
They did. We all know that in communist times, the Communist Party was telling on the Chinese. They are telling the media what to write now, and it's in our states is now. It's the same. It's part of it is coming from the economical side. Others come from the political side. Sometimes the journalists are bribed, or the whole, not the single journalist, but the whole media is just bought. The institutional corruption is when you don't have to bribe the single clerk, but if you buy the whole office. So then you don't have to need to, then you don't, there's no need in bribing single ones. You can just kick them off if they don't want to follow. They just can take new ones in the job.
Yes, I mean, we had evidence of that. I mean, you might have been referring to James Murdoch. Actually, I lost the name myself. But we spoke with Laura Dodsworth last night, who's the author of State of Fear. She interviewed a lot of the behavioral scientists, a lot of the people involved in the UK response, specifically looking at this kind of machine of fear. But she shared that the government basically had a hotline to the media, which would influence what they printed. Not only that, the government spent millions and continues to spend millions on newspaper advertising, billboard advertising. The message is controlled and paid for by the governments and the pharmaceutical companies. This is very evident. This is happening.
Yes. Well, there is a very good book about Britain. How Corrupt is Britain, it's called. And it's by Mr. White or so is the author. And it's an anthology. And there are many chapters on different parts of society, and it's about systemic corruption or institutional corruption. And I think it's a very good one. And this, you could write similar books to Germany and to other states too. Corruption is a real danger.
It's deep. I think there was an ex-mafia boss actually that wrote that Britain was one of the most corrupt financial systems in the world. I saw an article about that last year. Now, obviously, the comparisons are very clear here between the swine flu pandemic and other pandemics in the past, with what we've seen with COVID, and this. I was around during SARS. I was around during H1N1. I didn't ever once even hear about the idea of having a vaccine, or even think about it. Nor do I think about having a vaccine for the flu. To be quite frank, I'm perfectly healthy, young, take care of my health. But here we are in 2021, and Boris Johnson is about to address, our Prime Minister is about to address the G7 this weekend in Cornwall on the south coast of the UK, with the goal to vaccinate the world, to vaccinate every individual in the world. Mm-hmm. So we've gone from, the swine flu pandemic, where I can't even remember vaccines being talked about, to now it's inescapable. It's unavoidable. But not only that, people believe they have to exchange. It's an exchange that they are. 9 out of 10 young people I've spoken to said they're only getting the jab because they believe it will get their freedoms back, and they believe it will get their liberties back. None of them are doing it for, not one of them said that they were doing it for medical reasons. Not one of them did it because they believe they're at risk. They're all doing it as an exchange for their freedom.
I would advise UK to have certain regions as a control group. So if you have one region, take Scotland, for instance, they say, no, we don't get vaccinated. And the rest of UK can do what they want. And then find out who's better off. I think we don't have this. And it's a very, very big threat that all those side effects of the vaccination, what we already observe, we never had so many side effects on any vaccination as in this one, and deadly ones and severe ones. Those microthrombus people get, we are just having an examination now in Germany where we try to find out that people get tested before they get vaccinated and after, 1 week after, there is a certain, that a D-dimer is called. It's a certain, the rest of fibrin, when the thrombus is dissolving a little bit, you can measure it in the blood, and you can also count the thrombocytes, because when there is a microthrombus in the blood, you can see they are consumed, that there are the thrombocytes get lower, the values get lower. So when you see that after the vaccination, 7 days after the vaccination, perhaps already 5 days after the vaccinations, you have this symptoms in laboratory. That the D-dimers get up, that they rise a lot, and that the thrombocytes get down, there is some thrombus and a vaccination that makes a thrombus should never be given. Mm. This is a very dangerous complication. Sometimes you don't recognize the symptoms. Sometimes you only feel a little bit peculiar. Something doesn't function so well. Or if you have it, you don't know where the thrombus is. It may be in your intestine. It may be in your brain. It may be somewhere in your body, in the liver. So if everyone who drinks alcohol, he knows you can damage the liver a lot until you recognize that it is damaged. And so it's the same with thrombus. You don't easily recognize what is damaged. But when you have those laboratory values, you can see something like that happened. And this is always a big threat. If you're lucky, if it doesn't grow, the thrombus, and if you don't have severe symptoms. But many young people died with thrombosis. They have those thromboses in their veins, in the cerebral veins, the sinus thrombosis, or they had thrombosis in the mesenterium, in the intestine veins, or in the spleen. Or so many women get bleeding. Bleeding is another symptom. You may have a bleeding in the skin suddenly, and this happens because you have a low thrombosis. They are consumed. the thrombocytes are low, and then the bleeding doesn't stop so quickly, so you get such effects, and you can have many different signs. There is not one symptom of this microthrombosis. There are many symptoms, but the reason for those symptoms is that thrombocytes are consumed, that thrombocytes are aggregating, that they build lumps of blood, clots, and this is very severe. And a vaccination, which has those side effects, should not be on the market. And there's another reason against this vaccination. We are told by all those firms who want to sell them that they have an effectivity, I think, of 95%. You know what it means? This is a relative effect, relative protection of 95%. If you take 100,000 people, you don't vaccine them. You observe them for some time. And you take another 100,000 people and you give them the vaccine and you observe them, whether they get a positive PCR and some symptoms, that's what they did, or not. And you do this in both groups. And in the group which is not vaccinated, you have one case of PCR positive and symptoms. And in the vaccinated group, there's no case. You have an effectivity of 100%. Can you understand what it means?
Yes, you have
99,999 persons vaccinated only to save one positive PCR test, but it's 100% relative protection.
Yes,
relative. This is what they tell us when they save 95. Yet the real protection is the absolute protection is less than 1%. And the rest, 99%, comes from our immune system. It's already there. And the additional protection is only about 1% of those vaccines. And when you see all those side effects, I would never allow such a vaccination on the market. And I think it's a very big crime what they do with the population now.
Well, it's one thing subjecting adults to this during this state of emergency that we're supposedly in. I don't know by any stretch how the current situation can still be, certainly in the UK, labelled an emergency situation. Yet this has been obviously used to authorise these interventions. But now we face a really real threat. I call it a threat deliberately. But the children are now going to be exposed to this. And you know, we've looked at all of the data, and you know, young people have been the least vulnerable to this virus. There's been very few serious incidences, and every death that's been quantified in the UK, every death in the UK that's associated with COVID-19 in under 18s was people who had serious pre-existing conditions. That's been published in the Times in the United Kingdom. Yet we're now likely to put children through this, which I find deeply frightening and concerning. And I can only imagine that it's greed rather than need that is driving this. And I don't know where to turn, to be quite frank. You know, we try to raise the alarm about the situation, but that there's this mantra that no one is safe until we're all safe. And it's just getting into people's heads. It comes down to fear.
You know, it's. I think this is on one hand, it's greed. It's those people who want to sell their stuff, maybe. But the politicians who help them to do it, they don't have anything. They don't earn money. Most of them don't earn money with it. So this is not greed. This may be just ignorance. This may be just closing their eyes. They may be dependent on their bosses who are bribed or who are corrupt. Maybe the bosses of the government is corrupt, and the others are afraid to lose their jobs or lose their being member of parliament, lose their place on the list also. And I don't know there's such a mixture of political pressure, and we know there were politicians who were opposing. They had to suffer a lot, and some of them died in Africa and somewhere else in Germany too. So it is dangerous to oppose. And you lose your job if you're a professor in medicine who says this is a nonsense. You will immediately lose your jobs. And the higher you are, the deeper you fall.
Mm.
And it's such a might with such a power that is behind all this, which is the power of money. But the money is only powerful in a democracy when the democracy is corrupted.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's underpinned by a very dogmatic ideology that's swept through people. But that power of that vested interest is deep. And you're right that when the democracy is corrupted, then we're all of
doesn't function.
It doesn't function. We've seen the checks and balances completely eroded. We've seen policy decided on a Sunday afternoon and published on Monday morning without any scrutiny and evidence. I mean, I wrote a post this morning, this 10-point post saying that there's no transparency whatsoever at the moment around the current situation. It's all smoke and mirrors. Yeah, it's all being used to drive an outcome. And it's not just around vaccines. We've got a situation here where, as we've referenced, our life, our ability to access society is determined by a human characteristic, our medical records. Now, in history, when we've tried to separate society based upon any other medical or human characteristic, we know that has not gone particularly well in the past.
Yes, you know, I had an initiative when I was in German Parliament. I made an initiative when we were formulating the Charter of Human Rights and of the European Union. And there is such discrimination. They have an article against discrimination. And it was the first time we succeeded to get into this article against discrimination, that you may not be discriminated because of your genes.
Mm.
This was the first time that it was this explicitly adopted into such a charter. And it was our job in Germany, and I proposed it there. And I think I would not do it in this way again. I would have it more open. You know, you should not be discriminated because of the things you cannot influence. All the biological things you cannot influence, they cannot be used to discriminate you. If you do false things, you decide to be a criminal, or if you decide to damage other people, then you should be discriminated. You should be even put in prison if something like that happens. But if you cannot be discriminated because of your being biologically as you are. And it's not only the genes. We know much more now. That's epigenetic things, and even the viruses that shape our genes, and they form them all those centuries and thousands of years. They are part of our genome. They try to enter, and they live with us, and they shape our genome. And we would still lay eggs if we would not have viruses adopted.
And right, so I suppose with all of this in mind, I feel the situation feels incredibly bleak with this level of corruption. And this is not new. This is not a 2020, 2021 situation. We've looked at, in this conversation alone, the swine flu epidemic, 2005, 2002. And, you know, you've written a book on this whole situation, which I'll share in a moment. The big question for me becomes, what's the solution? How do we tackle this systemic corruption? How do we overcome this? You can see on the screen here Dr. Vodag's book, False Pandemics, where he's written about this subject extensively. It's not currently available in English, but you can get a copy in German. I'll put the link in the chat. But back to my question around how we can tackle the systemic corruption. What is the solution here, do you feel?
I was asked to do something politically, so I decided to help those people who want to change some, to want to avoid this in future, what happens now. And it's some new party in Germany. We don't know how it works. It's always when there is a new party, you don't know what it will be, but I think there are many clever people, and they are united all by the will that they want to avoid such destruction of democracy in the future. They want to have basic democracy. And I think when in democracy, we are governing from the people, it's a bottom up construction. We give our votes to certain parliamentarians, and we entrust them our power, and then they go for with our power, and then sometimes in Germany they go for 4 years, and then they are there for 4 years. They can do what they think is right, and it's difficult to interfere there. When we send someone wrong, who is corrupt or who is easily tricked out or is easily, influenced, we cannot say stop. And I think we should have parliamentarians where we can say, yes, we voted for you, but if there is a certain quorum in the constituency where he comes from and where he was sent, we should be able to say, no, we want a new election. Maybe we vote on you again if you can explain why you did what you did. But if you cannot, we will change out. We will send someone new. So this would say we don't have elections each year, but we have a continuum of parliamentarians who at the longest, maybe 4 or 5 years, stay there and maybe re-elected. Okay. But they are directly elected, not by a party. You know, when the party is in our time, is such an organization where you can get a politician only by ass creeping.
Yes.
Where you can be friendly to your party leaders and you get a good place on the list, and suddenly you are in parliament and you only look at your party leaders. So if someone wants to influence politics, he only has to buy the party leaders, has to bribe them. And then the party leaders can watch whom they send to parliament and whom they give the possibility to be elected. And this cannot be in a democracy. I think I want a democracy where we have only directly voted, where the candidates are voted directly. And when the constituency doesn't like what they do, there can be a certain quorum of people and they say, we want a re-election. And then you can exchange the politicians. And they have to be aware of this. So they have to be accountable for all they do. And they have to ask every question. And so that means that the politicians have to have a very good office, because they are really at stake then. They have to answer many questions. They have to be aware of the people and of the interests in the population. And they have to show the people why they decide, how they decide. They have to make clear that you always have to have compromises. And you may be wrong with what you decide, but you do the best you can. And so I think this has to be transparent. And this, in our parliamentarian system, I know all those parliamentarian systems in Europe, I know this is not the case. Mm. We have the parties, and the parties, they are such sub-organizations that are between democracy and government somewhere. And I think there could be parties where we discuss political theories, and what we should vote on, we should agree on single persons that are accountable then. We have this for the Lord Mayors of big cities and what for the district mayors in Germany. They are directly voted. And we very often have, when there are very good people from one party or even from no party, and they say, I want to become the Lord Mayor here, all the parties agree on, because this is a good woman or this is a good guy, we vote for him. No matter which party he is a member of, they want to have the best person. And like this, it should be with parliamentarians too. I wrote something about that in my book too, because you always have to have a dream. And I know there is a big structure of power now, and parties are very powerful. And those who pay the parties, they are more powerful still, because the parties live from money from I don't know where. And this is another thing. I also would say there is no lobby allowed in parliament. No lobby, neither in Brussels nor in Berlin. They should not be allowed to go to parliament. They should be allowed to go to the parliamentarians in their constitution, in their circumscription, and it should be public debates. They should publicly say what they want. And the parliamentarians would have the responsibility to have a look on all the interests conflicting with what they want, and let the people come together and let it be discussed and find the best solution. So, and the worst thing are those lobby firms, you know, the lobby firms, the big lobby firms, who mostly there are former politicians who work for them, who have the entry, who can easily contact any other politician. And if you have enough money, you have a big influence in politics through those professional lobbyists. And this is, for a democracy, it's just deadly. You know, if someone who has money has more influence on politics as someone who has no money. I think the professional lobbyists should be banned. And if there should be lobbyism, people should organize and say what they want. They should be well informed. They should be helped to say what they want, but not there such big firms. I don't want to say some names, but we all know them, and they go in and out in every ministry, and they buy the politicians, try to bribe the politicians. We have these revolving door mechanisms everywhere, and this is just deadly for democracy. But it won't change until the voters don't want it, until they want it. When the voters say, no, we want it differently, then the party who says, okay, we follow you, maybe vote it, maybe may change it. And this is what my hope. This was your questions. How could it be in future? And this is my hope. I have a dream, yeah?
Well, okay. I too have a dream, and I share that dream with you, Dr. Vodak. I think what this last 12 months, if there is a blessing from all of this situation, if there's a single blessing that is of an order of magnitude that has a potential for impact, I believe it's this corruption, the inadequacies of the current systems, the flaws, the manipulation, that all of this has risen to the surface. It's bubbled to the surface, and more people have become aware of these issues. And when more people become aware of these issues, it creates the conditions for change. And I believe that this summer, I call it the summer of freedom. It's almost upon us now. The sun is shining upon me here in this office space. And I believe this summer, the summer of freedom, is our opportunity to evaluate how we can reimagine, how we can change every part of the world going forward. I think people are ready to say enough is enough. The political systems need overhauling. The financial systems need overhauling. The education systems need overhauling. It's time to reimagine a better world for the people and the planet. And what better time than now to step forward with that dream and to start effecting real change? I believe that there is a cultural counterculture or a counterculture movement emerging that dreams like you and I do here today. And I think many of those watching live today with us are also fellow dreamers who wish to change the world. So on that happy note, having covered some of the darkness and bring light to the end, I want to thank you sincerely for being here today. And I want to thank you for the work that you've done, from what I've learned about your work that you've done today, and continue to do, and obviously for your appearance here on the Pandemic Podcast. And I'd like to thank all of our audience who have participated live in the comments, engaging the conversation and sharing this broadcast. I will give a final call to action to those watching. Please do share this. We've been temporarily restricted from broadcasting on Facebook for simply talking about natural immunity. We were discussing how young people, when they're exposed to it, to a virus, can actually form natural immunity and contribute to the overall community. We got banned for saying that. That's what we believe we were banned for. So we do need your help in sharing these broadcasts whilst we're temporarily blocked on one of our primary channels. So please do share this. And if you haven't done so already, please just take 1 minute of your time to go to danjgregory.com/pandemic and subscribe to our newsletter, where we'll keep you informed of the other platforms that we're bringing and some of the solutions that we're working on under the Summer of Freedom, including our Make Lockdowns History event coming up on July the 17th here in the UK. So thank you once again for your participation in this wonderful conversation today. Thank you to our audience. Good night to everyone, and I'll see you soon for our next episode. I'm taking a short break. I'll be back next week from Wednesday. I'll be reporting on Monday when the decisions are made in Parliament, but I'm taking a short break from broadcasting back next week. So thanks for everyone's patience, and thank you for tuning in again, and good night.